Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Joan Walsh, filling in for Brian, who's on vacation. Some of you know me from CNN, where I'm a political analyst, and I'm also the national affairs correspondent for The Nation. It's really tough to fill in for Brian, but with a news week like this, he would want us to carry on. We have a great, important show for you, and I think we're actually going to hit most, I shouldn't say all, of the big news of the week. I know it's only Wednesday, hump day, but it feels like Friday. President Trump made his second appointment to the Supreme Court on Monday night with a made-for-reality TV dramatic scripting. He gave the rose to conservative Brett Kavanaugh at 9 p.m. after keeping us guessing about a short list of four finalists. And in other legal news, we learned that the Trump administration missed a court-imposed Tuesday deadline to reunite undocumented children under five who were taken from their parents with their families. In yet another court decision, a judge upheld an earlier ruling that undocumented children cannot be detained even with their parents for more than 20 days. There's no clear word yet on what the administration's going to do on either front, but it's harrowing. Meanwhile, the president is at a NATO summit, and he's already told us that a later meeting with Vladimir Putin is going to be easier than meeting with our historic allies. We've got Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group who'll be here and make sense of that for us. But given all the legal news, I can't think of anyone better to have as our first guest than Emily Bazelon, a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a senior research fellow at Yale Law School, and co-host of the Slate podcast, The Political Gab Fest. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
I also want to welcome our callers. The number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Okay, Emily, it's been 36 hours or so since Kavanaugh got the nod. What have we learned? And tell me what you think is important about the rollout on both sides, from the Trump and conservative side, as well as the Democrat rollout of their response.
You know, I think both sides are gearing up for a huge fight. And so for the Republicans, it was really important to present Kavanaugh as likable. I think he spent more time talking about his kids and their sports, his coaching of their basketball teams, than his judicial record. He was, you know, up there as a family man, especially the father of girls. And for the Democrats, I think explaining why he is very conservative is crucial. I've been noticing in the last few days this kind of funny phenomenon where various people on the right who have talked about how important it is to have a very conservative justice, especially someone willing to, limit abortion rights or overturn Roe v. Wade, suddenly are kind of minimalizing the chances that those things will happen.
Yes,
now
yes.
It's time to kind of paint him as mild and not someone who will shake up the status quo. But I just don't think that's true. You know, what we know about Judge Kavanaugh, based on everything in his record, is this is a very conservative judge who could be an even more conservative justice.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned his comments about his daughters, because we have the clip of him talking about them that I want to play for you right now.
I have two spirited daughters, Margaret and Liza. Margaret loves sports, and she loves to read. Liza loves sports, and she loves to talk. I have tried to create bonds with my daughters like my dad created with me. For the past 7 years, I have coached my daughters' basketball teams. The girls on the team call me Coach K.
Now, I personally didn't find that totally convincing, and in fact, I found it a little bit condescending. Feminists are convinced that he's going to participate in somehow overturning Roe v. Wade. Can you explain why? What's in his background that makes so many feminist groups so concerned about this?
Well, I mean, on paper, in his academic writings, Kavanaugh has tried to kind of thread the needle by talking about Roe as settled precedent, but saying it is precedent because that's what the Supreme Court decided, which is different from saying, you know, it was correct or that it has its own basis in the Constitution. And he also was the author of a dissent last year in a case where an undocumented teenager who was in federal government custody asked for an abortion, and the Trump administration didn't want to help her find an abortion provider, was blocking her from doing that. And the majority of the panel Kavanaugh was on said that this girl had the right to have an abortion. Judge Kavanaugh said, no, she didn't. And he used, dramatic phrase in saying that the government was trying to sort of create a brand new right to abortion on demand, which, you know, that's the kind of rhetoric you use when you're trying to attract a little attention, have a little flair.
It's advocacy rhetoric. It's what the other side says. It's the way they describe, you know, their worst fears. So I think that did set off alarm bells. For a lot of the pro-choice advocates. I want to be sure to get our callers in. We already have some callers coming. If you have a question for my guest, Emily Bazelon, call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. I also want to get a little bit into the weeds on his approach to the Affordable Care Act. I've been doing a bit of reporting on this for The Nation, and it seems like the advocates think that maybe even more than Roe, the best line of attack on Kavanaugh is what they perceive as his hostility to the Affordable Care Act. We know that the Trump administration is refusing to defend its constitutionality in court, so folks think, even though the Roberts Court famously did find it constitutional, so folks think it's going to come back to the Supreme Court. I want to play you a clip of what President Trump said about whether overturning the ACA would be or should be any kind of litmus test for a Supreme Court nominee.
I will tell you this, Justice Roberts really let us down. He really let us down. What he did with Obamacare was disgraceful. And I think he did that because he wanted to be popular with inside the Beltway or something.
So explain to us where you think advocates are getting their conviction that Kavanaugh's a solid vote against the ACA and whether they're right.
Well, before the Supreme Court's ruling, before Chief Justice Roberts was the fifth vote a couple of times to uphold Obamacare, Judge Kavanaugh, again in dissent, said that he would not do so. And he kind of laid out a middle road that would allow the government, would allow the courts to overturn parts of the law in a way that would weaken the law. And so that's the record that I think advocates, you know, people in favor of Obamacare are talking about now.
I'd like to take a call. Lynn from Brooklyn, you're here with us. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
How you doing?
Okay. Ever since, you know, they've been talking about Judge Kavanaugh and his strict constructionist of the Constitution, and this question just keeps bugging me, and that is, why does a strict constructionist not read the entire Second Amendment and only deal with the second part, the part about that this is about the militia? They don't read that at all, and these are supposed to be strict constructionists. Why don't they read the first part?
Do you have an answer, Emily?
The Second Amendment is such a confounding set of phrases. It's like sort of has extra commas floating around in it. It's hard to know how the clause about the militia relates to the part about the right to bear arms. And, you know, when the Supreme Court basically said there is an individual right to bear arms, they had a big fight about the historical precedent behind the Second Amendment, what the framers were thinking or not thinking when they drafted it. So, you know, it's really an argument where historically there is evidence on both sides. It's an issue where originalism, the idea of going back to the text and the framers, does not settle the dispute.
It seemed to me that one of the things that happened yesterday is that in the second day coverage or day and a half coverage, Democrats in the media began to really focus on Kavanaugh's expansive views on presidential power and the president's possible exemption to criminal prosecution, even investigation. He's written some pretty remarkable things, and I just want to read you a couple. There's a now famous 2009 Minnesota Law Review piece. He said the president should be excused from time-consuming and distracting lawsuits and investigations which would, quote, ill serve the public interest, especially in times of financial or national security crisis. He said the only recourse is if the president is suspected of breaking the law is impeachment by Congress. And he wrote, no single prosecutor, judge, or jury should be able to accomplish what the Constitution assigns to the Congress. Now, this is really odd because he did work for independent counsel Kenneth Starr investigating Bill Clinton. He once said he thought Clinton's delaying his grand jury testimony, just delaying it, was obstruction of justice, and that could be grounds for impeachment. He does write in the Law Review that, you know, belatedly he thinks that the Starr investigation did overreach and maybe hurt Clinton. But how seriously should we take these writings? Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon told me, he calls it Trump's potential, quote, get out of jail free card.
I mean, I think we take them seriously. He's on the record about them. They are statements that directly apply to these looming questions, depending on what Robert Mueller's investigation finds. You know, we don't know that there is going to be grounds for a criminal indictment of the president, but in the lead up to that are questions about whether Mueller can subpoena the president. There have been two unanimous Supreme Court decisions in the past about Clinton and Nixon that don't directly settle this question, but suggest that the answer is yes, a special counsel would be able to subpoena the president. It looks like Kavanaugh would have some serious doubts about that. So it will be interesting to watch him try to dance around these questions at his confirmation hearings, because surely he's not going to want to answer them directly.
Definitely. We've got Dina from Manhattan who wants to talk to you. Hello, Dina.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Yes, no one's above the law in this country, and it's obvious that Donald Trump selected someone who will make it difficult for the prosecutor, Mueller, to continue his investigation. It's not just about the election, which is so egregious, but what about all the women who have lawsuits? And what about all the workers in the real estate industry who he hasn't paid, and all the lawsuits against this occupier of the White House? You know, we have to stop this, and we have to, all of us have to do something to stop it, because it's just changing everything in our country.
I mean, you're right that there are these civil suits that are also an issue. And in the past, the Supreme Court has said that the president may be sued civilly, and the court did not accept the argument that the problem of distraction and time meant that the president could be spared a civil lawsuit. That is another precedent that will be, you know, we don't know what will happen, but it's certainly possible that a Justice Kavanaugh would have a vote in deciding that kind of issue.
Just one last question on this. I hate to leave it, but I also do want to talk to you about the crisis on the border. But, you know, there are going to be fights within fights as this rolls out. And one that is shaping up is that Democrats are demanding the full email and document record of Brett Kavanaugh. And given that he goes back to the Starr investigation 20 years ago, and given that he was the staff secretary for President George W. Bush, given that he was staff secretary in the post 9/11 period, when there may well be a lot of very interesting emails back and forth on our detention policies, on civil liberties, on bulk email data collection, et cetera, they're saying that there could be a million documents. I don't even know how they came up with that number. It could be more, right? Republicans are starting to say, oh my goodness, we have, you know, we know so much about him. These don't speak to judicial philosophy. This could delay things till September, which it really could. Do you think the Democrats can win at least this small battle for full disclosure of his documents?
This is the trickiest part of the confirmation process for Republicans. And this is why the Times reported that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, had some misgivings about choosing Kavanaugh. And it's going to be a really interesting fight. I mean, the Republicans have an incentive, obviously, to move things forward quickly. There's an important norm at stake about disclosure. You know, previously we have had the government turn over documents that Supreme Court nominees touched. The staff secretary for a president touches an enormous number of documents. And so I imagine that's going to be the sticking point is, you know, was the fact that Kavanaugh was CC'd on various communications a good enough reason to release them? And given the volume, you know, how much will the Republicans agree to respect this norm when there is a substantial chance of slowing down the nomination?
Right. But we do have the precedent, if you'll call it that, of asking for Elena Kagan's White House documents. And I think we went they went back and they got John Roberts as well. So
and Sam Alito's, too.
And Sam Alito's. So this has been a bipartisan request in the past. So, you know, I mean, there's no predicting what Republicans in the Senate will do. But Jeff Merkley at least thinks they have a decent shot at getting them to respect their own history of disclosure. I want to take a call from Andy in South Orange, New Jersey. Hi, Andy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I appreciate the attention and the analysis that you all are directing to this, but I respectfully suggest that it's all a distraction. The record has already been thoroughly vetted on this guy. He's been through Senate confirmation twice, and we're not going to find any secret things, any terrible documents, anything more outrageous than you've already discussed in his own judicial and academic record. But that is a distraction. They've made clear what they want. The Federalist Society is absolutely clear what it wants. The Trump administration is absolutely clear what it wants, and they are going to get it, or at least do everything they can. So to suggest that this is going to be judged on the merits rather than the explicit statement to overturn Roe v. Wade or the Affordable Care Act or anything, other things that are targets of this administration, it seems to me, with all due respect, a sucker's game.
Well, Andy, with respect and reply, you know, some of the civil rights folks that I've talked to feel like there really may well be things in these documents, especially from his time in the Bush White House, that we don't know about, that we haven't seen before, and that could raise questions, particularly about civil liberties. There are, you know, there are some Republicans who at least give lip service and sometimes more than that to concerns about national security overreach in the wake of 9/11. So, you know, I'm not saying I am optimistic about this, but there's a possibility that you could get somebody like Rand Paul or even it's another way into Lisa Murkowski or Dan Sullivan. Emily, what do you think about that?
I think those are good points. I also think that there's the outcome of this nomination and then there's the process and what the country learns in the process, not just like looking for some scurrilous secret, but learns about this person, about his ideological views, about his background. And it's an opportunity for Democrats to try to enforce also a norm of transparency, which is important. You know, one of the confusing things about the last 18 months have been how many norms have just kind of eroded or been outright broken in front of our eyes. So to me, the question of whether, you know, all these disclosures turn a vote, sure, that is a big deal. But it also, the process matters for these other political and legal reasons as well.
And one last question, and then I really am going to switch to the crisis on the border and all the legal stuff that's going on around that. But somebody that I spoke with yesterday, given that Andy brought up the Federalist Society vetting Judge Kavanaugh, wondered if it's possible to get access to their documents that they used to vet him and the other candidates, because I believe in the case of Justice Sotomayor, I'm blanking on the name, Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund, I think it was. They were forced to produce documents for some work that she did for them. Now, that may be more of a direct connection than Kavanaugh and the Federalist Society, but do you think that there's any hope in getting any access to either the Federalist or Heritage paperwork on vetting?
If I remember correctly, Justice Sotomayor was either on the board of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund or she did some work for them as a lawyer, and that's why those documents were released. I think no, and this no, the papers from the Federalist Society and Heritage will not come out, and this is part of the really smart strategy of the Trump administration of outsourcing all of this vetting and creating of Supreme Court lists to a non-government organization because they're not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests in the same way.
Yes, good and depressing point. We could talk about this all day, but I really do want to focus us on the crisis at the border. You know, as our caller Andy said, I don't consider this a distraction at all, the Kavanaugh nomination, but there's so much going on at the same time.
So true.
It's hard. It's hard to know where to focus, and I definitely want to get us back there, which means we're probably not going to take more calls on Kavanaugh, but we would love to have your calls on your thoughts about child detention and what's happening in our name. So I invite you again, give us a call, 212-433-WMYC. That's 212-433-9692. So, Emily, can you explain what happened with the under 5-year-olds yesterday? The administration was supposed to return 102 kids under 5, some babies, I believe, as young as 1, to their parents, and they only managed to reunite 38. What happened?
I mean, this has just been such a devastating set of events to watch. I certainly, as a parent, can't help but respond kind of emotionally to it. The government is having a lot of trouble reuniting these families because they seem to have deleted some of the information in the initial paperwork that connected them. And I don't mean to suggest that that was some act of malevolence. It seemed to have to do with the fact that there are these two agencies, Customs Border Patrol on one hand, and then the Department of Health and Human Services, and they're not quite, they didn't coordinate with each other. And so they ended up with children in detention, and they honestly don't seem to know who the parents are in all these cases. And of course, for very young children, you can't rely on the child's, to tell you who it is. And so we are just having this set of heartbreaking hearings unfold before a judge who seems very determined to make this process happen in a timely way. He does not want the Trump administration to just, run out the clock. But on the other hand, you have to make sure that you're handing the children over to the correct people. And sure, that bureaucratic hassle is, causing a lot of delay and more heartbreak.
Yes, and some of the heartbreak, even in these cases where they know that the child belongs to the parent, because of some of the long separations, we're seeing kids not recognize their parent, which is actually kind of a common reaction to being, even in the best of circumstances, to being away from a parent when you're a very small child.
Sure. From a child's point of view, it's an abandonment, which is, of course, not to say it's the parent's fault, just
no,
that's the experience from the child's side.
So the judge did ask the ACLU to recommend penalties for the government's failure to unite all these families. Do you have thoughts on what the penalty should be?
That's an interesting question. I mean, the idea that the government can cause such damage and behave so cruelly, what would be appropriate? I would want the penalties to be things that would prevent this from happening in the future, just really limiting their ability to take children away and even to hold families in detention together, because that is also something that, they're moving toward. But there is a court settlement. It's called the Flores Settlement from 1997 in place that limits strictly the time period for family detention to 20 days. So, if judges could figure out prospectively how to prevent these kinds of separations from happening again, maybe you could force the agency to submit plans about making sure that you would not have these same situations where they can't find parents anyway.
Well, right. That's what I was going to ask you about next, was the upholding of the Flores decision, which does mean that, so for a while the answer was, yeah, we're still going to detain these families, but we will keep them together. Now the ruling was that, no, you can't go more than 20 days, and that's going to force another recalibration of this policy. But I do want to take a call. We've got Dan in Massapequa, Long Island. Hi, Dan. You're on WNYC.
Hey, good morning. Quite a complex issue we have. I'm probably one of the few people in the country, apparently, that can see both sides of the argument and has an array of opinions. And I always feel I see this things going on, and it's it's very confusing because I think we can all agree that if a person enters the country illegally, I would like to think this would be normal, just as if a person robs a bank, then unless they're, if they haven't gone through the asylum properly, then they must be detained and arrested for breaking our law. I think we have laws on the books. They've been passed in bipartisan fashion. And if you're going to have a law, the law then needs to be enforced, no matter what the law is, so the law can be respected. So if a person comes across the border and they entered illegally, they get arrested. So now, if they have a child with them, and I spent 20 years in the police department, and I remember arresting people in their houses, and the children were then left with the child welfare people. We would take them. We would bring the child. If we couldn't find somebody adequate to have the child, we would bring the child to BCW in Lower Manhattan, and they'd sleep on the floor for a week until their parents got, you know, out of jail or something. So there's a... It always seems like it's our fault, the fact that we're trying to enforce our border. And I have a great sympathy for these people. I spent a lot of my life working in very poor, underserved neighborhoods, and I understand a lot of the issues at hand on both sides of the issue. But it always seems like we're the bad guy. It's our fault. And now you look at these children. They're showing up with people. Nobody has any identification. We don't even know if the children are actually their children. And now I'm being told that the children aren't recognizing their parents after 3 weeks or 3 months. When I work in an army base in a 306 engineers unit, just came back from 13 months in Kuwait, and every one of those kids recognized their parents. So,
well,
I think it's being over-dramatized.
Dan, thank you so much. I just want to jump in with a personal story. My mom had my brother when I was 13 months old. I was with my aunt for a week, and I didn't recognize my mother when she came back, and it was a sadness of her whole life. So I know for a fact that does happen, even if you didn't see it. I really do appreciate your trying to see both sides. Emily, can you just walk us through how this is different from, you know, someone just breaking a law and then being separated from their kids? Because, as Dan says, that is what we do.
Well, I want to start by saying I'm always glad to hear from police officers who've worked in underserved communities and come out of that with a sense of empathy for the people they work with. So one thing I think to think about here is the principle of proportionality. When you cross the border illegally, you're generally committing a misdemeanor offense. And I don't think we usually take children away from their parents for months for misdemeanor offenses in this country. You know, also, when you cross the border and you say that you're seeking asylum, you're not the same as someone who's just, like, showing up for another reason. You have a different set of rights. They try to figure out if you have a credible fear, that's the legal phrase, of going home and what that fear is based on. And while you're going through that asylum process, you can be detained. But traditionally in this country, we haven't done that. We've, you know, let people move freely in the country, sometimes with ankle bracelets. There was a pilot program a couple of years ago the government tried that had very high success rates of asylum seekers coming back to court when they trusted the process. And so, you know, if you have a choice and someone is trying to come to this country, they say they're terribly frightened, they're coming from a very violent place, do we ramp up immediately to putting them in jail and warehousing their children somewhere else and then losing the identifying connection between those two? That seems like quite an extreme punishment.
Yes. We've got a Utah editorial board who compared it to the kind of behavior that gets people hauled before the International Criminal Court. Or a war crimes tribunal. I know that sounds maybe a little hysterical, but you're not allowed to harm the families of even people you're at war with intentionally. But this is what Donald Trump said on Tuesday. I just want to play a short clip.
Tell people not to come to our country illegally. That's the solution. Don't come to our country illegally. Come like other people do. Come legally.
And I want to bring in a caller, Ryan from Colonia, New Jersey, who has a question for you, Emily, too, on this topic.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi there. I think you guys just kind of solved my second question about legality of crossing the border, seeking asylum, not at a port of entry. But my other question was, why is there no protection for unaccompanied minors not receiving a public defender? No one, of course, expects a 1, 3, or 5-year-old to represent themselves in an immigration court. should there be some kind of protection for that?
Yes, it does seem like there should be, right? The sort of spectacle of toddlers by themselves in a chair before a judge is, doesn't seem like it should comport with our legal system. However, immigration law is a kind of crazy wild west. There are a few rules, but there is not a guarantee of representation, even if you are a small child. And so, you know, it's been really amazing to watch the volunteer legal services across the country and just the army of lawyers who volunteered to help. But that doesn't mean that they're going to be able to cover every case. And all the issues we have about providing free legal services for people come into play even more to a kind of, you know, nth degree in immigration cases.
Because there really is no clear right to representation. So we are in many ways reliant on this army of volunteers. And I have to say, you know, as someone who always looks for the silver linings, or as Mr. Rogers would say, look for the helpers. Those helpers are the best. And the people sending money to get the volunteer lawyers down to the border are incredible. I'm going to have to wrap it here, Emily. I could talk to you all day. This has been really great. I want to let our callers know two things. We know we had a lot of calls about Judge Kavanaugh, and we are going to be talking about specifically about New York State abortion law in our next segment with State Senator Liz Krueger and a journalist, Alexis Grinnell. And also, at the end of the show, we're going to talk to author Lauren Markham, who's written a great book about twins who migrated alone from El Salvador. So we'll have more to talk about with this. Thank you, Emily. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Joan Walsh in for Brian, and we'll be right back.